session number 17551, reel 3.
Now, about the German prisoner of war camp numbers?
Well, to some extent they were logical. The army camps were named from the army district, so you got Salag 3E, which I was in for a time, Salag 8B, which was in the 8th district and was a sort of second camp in the 8th district, and so on. And then you suddenly get one like Salag 357. Now, where did that come from? There's no, as far as we know, there's no 356, 355, or anything else. It doesn't seem to have any logic to it. Probably there is some logic to it, but nobody ever explained it to me or to anybody else that I know. But as I say, the Luft camps were named just sequentially.
You're also telling me off the record that the RAF NCOs were better off than the RAF officers as POWs. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Not while we were POWs so much, but financially, that's really what I meant, because we had none of our pay deducted, which has been a recent fight of argument about getting their money back, but without any success. And of course, we were, by the standards of the day, you know, aircrew were very well paid. As a warrant officer, I was getting a guinea a day, which these days wouldn't sound very much, but went a long way in 1945.
Now, if we can pick up the narrative that you were giving me of arriving at Fallingbostel.
Yes, well, we were moved across Germany in cattle trucks. It wasn't all that horrendous. It took about 3 days, I think. And we arrived at this place, Fallingbostel, which again was 357. But, of course, that part of Poland where we'd been was quite shortly afterwards occupied by the Russians, so I mean they had to move out. The fabric of the German state was holding pretty firm, but beginning to creak at the edges. It was one of the things that we depended on for our sustenance were the Red Cross parcels. If they couldn't get through, then we were pretty well on starvation rations. And there were periods of the war when we didn't get them. Notably, when we were first at Salag 6, and earlier than that, when we were at Salag 3E. At Torren, we did have some Red Cross parcels, and at Fallingbostel, they were coming in then on great white-painted Swedish, look like furniture vans almost. They came from Sweden. They were painted white with red crosses on all sides, large red crosses. And they seemed to manage to get through one way or another. We still managed to organise our camp school in Fallingbostel. One of the things about it was we were sort of hypersensitive about any idea that we were cheating the system, or, you know, that's why the exam papers were always kept outside the compound in the Vorlager, in the German administrative quarters. I think the Germans rather encouraged our education things because they kept us quiet. So we... One or two of the strange things did happen because of the wartime situation, I suppose, but I think it was the accountants who have an economics paper, and so do the surveyors, I think chartered surveyors. And we discovered that the paper that the accountants had taken 3 weeks earlier was identical to the one that was now being set for the Chartered Surveyors. So our people who organised, the organisers of the education department, decided the only thing to do was to set a paper ourselves, which with the help of the economists in the camp, we proceeded to do to roughly the same standard, and we explained in a letter what we'd done, and we were congratulated on our probity and the general, our general attitude to the whole thing, which did us a lot of good. Anyway, as I was saying before, I think when we weren't being recorded, this Oxford Certificate in Social Studies exam arrived, and as the papers were similar to the London exam I had been studying for, I decided to have a go, and as a result got this certificate, and as a result went to Oxford after the war. It's there, actually, if you want to have a look at it. And then, right towards the end of the war, in April 1945, which fortunately was a very warm, fine spring, they decided to move the aircrew out of 357 and moved us up to, well, in the general direction of Lübeck, though we never got there, and we marched out of the camp one April morning. Though march is probably the wrong word. Ambled, perhaps, is a better word. And spread out over the German countryside, we acquired various farm carts and other sort of vehicles on the way, and loaded all our kit bags and such under the farm carts. Our guards, if you can call them guards at that time, were very elderly, with German First World ribbons up probably. And before we'd gone very far, we had their kit bags as well. And towards the end of this curious migration, we had their rifles also on board these things, which this merry party wandered across the German countryside. Except it wasn't always that merry, because we were marching in parallel columns along different roads. And one occasion, one of the columns was shot up by RAF Typhoons, and three or four people were killed as a result. I'm sure Dixie Dean might have told you about this. And some of them were people who had been prisoners of war for 5 years or more, you know, and to get right to the very end, and they were shot up by what is now euphemistically called friendly fire. It was really pretty rotten. Anyway, ultimately, we ended up, we found a large German farm, large enough to have its own dairy and cheese place, excuse me. And so we decided that we might as well stay there till the war caught up with us. And the Oberleutnant, who was nominally in charge of us, thought, well, it wasn't such a bad idea. So we just stayed there for about a week, leaving off, living off the chicken and eggs and cheese that this camp, this farm had, and generally waiting for something to happen. And what happened was that there was a main road about half a mile away, and Chuck came running into the camp and said, I think we've been liberated. And we had been liberated, but in the shape of a corporal of the Guards Armoured Division on the motorbike. And then gradually other troops arrived, and the Guards Armoured, and advised us to get to the main road and commandeer any German transport we fancied, and turn it round and make towards the Rhine, which we did. We managed to get hold of a Mercedes staff car being driven by an Oberst, which is a German colonel. And we drove this thing along, thinking it might be an idea to try and get it home, because there was not a chance. And then we were gradually sort of fuddled into various sort of organisation. We remember camped one night in a big field, a mixed crowd of Americans and British ex-POWs. And I think we were all enchanted by the sight of white bread. I mean, the white bread of this country wasn't white at the time, but they were making a big sort of show of the idea they had white bread. And then another night we stayed in a cotton mill somewhere in the Ruhr area, great feature of which was the fact that it had hot showers. We hadn't seen hot water for goodness knows when, so we thoroughly enjoyed these. Because wherever you went at that time, you were sprayed with DDT. Later on, DDT got a bad name, but it cured any sort of sign of bugs and lice that you might have. So you got rather used to everywhere you stopped, DDT was sprayed up your sleeves and down your trousers and down the back of your neck. I always remember this that night in the cotton mill because we were all settling down to go to sleep. Somebody saw a large lead switch, and out of idle curiosity, they pressed it, and all this weaving looms clattered into life all of a sudden at about midnight. It actually jumped out of my skin anyway. That was a sort of temporary aberration. And then we were gradually funneled into an airfield. And Bomber Harris had organised Lancasters to come in and fly us out. And we flew out to an airfield somewhere near Epsom. And I tried to telephone home from a call box and found that was impossible. So I sent a telegram saying home soon or some words to that effect. With which they refused to take any payment, which I suppose was par for the course at the time. Then we moved to a place near Wolverhampton, where we were sort of processed, given new uniforms and a certain amount of our back pay, and sent home on 6 weeks' leave, which was rather reasonable. Then we were given various choices of whether we could stay in the Air Force, but if we did stay in, we had to stay in for a minimum, I think it was 2 years, because we needed retraining, you know. Things had changed. Or we could come out immediately. Well, in the meantime, I'd got a place at Oxford, so I came out immediately. And I actually started in Oxford in January 46, which you could do in those days. You could start at the beginning of any term and finish at the end of any term, you know, because Oxford, of all the universities I knew, had adapted themselves to the situation. Liverpool University wouldn't have me, incidentally, because I hadn't got Latin in my matric. But the home of the classics didn't really seem to mind. So I went to Oxford without Latin in my matric. Cambridge hadn't adapted themselves at all. They were still running their full courses. You had to start in October and all that, you see. So full marks to Oxford, as far as I'm concerned.
Did your PRW experience leave you with any long-term effects in any way?
I don't think so, you know, really. I mean, you can sort of... No, I don't think so. Except, of course, I wouldn't have gone to university if I hadn't been a prisoner of war, so I suppose that's a long-term effect, in a way.
What about in your attitudes towards the Germans?
It took me a long time to get over the Germans. I instinctively avoided buying German goods for a long time, you know. So I decided it was getting a bit ridiculous, you know, after 40 or 50 years. But, you know, I did have a residual anti-German feeling. Though I can't say there were many occasions when we were really badly treated, my particular lot. There were people who were badly treated. People who ended up in the concentration camps, for example. And, of course, the infamous instance at Stalingrad 3 after we'd left, you know, the Great Escape business, where they shot 50-odd officers.
Do you remember that?
Well, I wasn't in Stalingrad 3 then. I was in Stalingrad 6, or maybe... No, I was probably in Stalingrad 357 by then. But...
So what was it about the Germans that made you antipathetic towards them for a time?
Oh, I think it was just a general feeling that they'd started it all, you know, and, you know, sort of, well, I think they did, that we blame them for the war and everything that's happened, you know.
Some people often ask me if the people I interview ever say anything about the effect of the war on their attitude towards religion. Did it have any effect on you in that way, the war?
No, I don't think so. No, I was fairly non-religious when the war started. I was fairly non-religious when it ended, you know.
Did the RAF chaplain seem to play any role?
Hardly any at all, I don't think, as far as I was concerned.
And another thing people seem to be interested in is the business of morale and lack of moral fibre.
Mm.
Do you remember anything about that?
No, I don't. I think the morale amongst the air crew I knew in Coastal Command was really very high, I would think. I think it may have been partly because we did such a variety of different sort of jobs. It wasn't like Bomber Command at all. Where you went night after night, and you knew every time the chances were that two or three weren't going to come back out of your squadron. That, I think, had a more effect than in Coastal, where we were doing different jobs. We really went out in squadron strength. Went out two or three of us.